Hi, Eric.
Hi, Henry. How are you?
Not too bad. And how are you in Chicago?
I'm doing well, and I guess we should introduce ourselves. I'm Eric Posner. I teach at the University of Chicago Law School.
And I'm Henry Farrell, and I teach at George Washington University's Department of Political Science and School of International Affairs.
So, Henry, I think we were going to start off and talk about this interesting paper you've written about blog readership and polarization. Why don't you start off and tell us what your argument is, and I'll react.
Well, this is a paper which I've co-authored with two colleagues here at George Washington, Eric Lawrence and John Sides. And really what we've tried to do is to take the first serious data set that anybody's been able to get their hands on blog readership, to try and figure out what do blog readers actually look like in terms of the kinds of information that they consume and in terms of their willingness to participate in politics. I guess to give the quick and dirty version of our main findings, we find, first of all, that blog readers are much more likely to participate than our regular members of the public, at least insofar as this, the sample that we look at, which has several thousand people who are surveyed, at least insofar as that sample indicates. Secondly, we find that political blog readers tend overwhelmingly to read blogs which have the same ideological persuasions as they themselves have, so that left-wing blog readers tend to read overwhelmingly left-wing blogs, right-wing blog readers tend overwhelmingly to read right-wing blogs. Thirdly, we find that the ideological profile of blog readers is quite different from the ideological profile of people who, for example, watch TV news, so that we find that blog readers tend to be very liberal, very conservative, not all that many people in the center of the political spectrum, whereas, for example, viewers of ABC News tend to be much more evenly spread. And finally, we find that blog readers tend to be substantially more likely than members of the ordinary public to actually engage actively in politics, and that left-wing blog readers tend to be statistically significantly more likely to participate in politics than right-wing blog readers. So that's the quick and dirty version of our major research findings.
And why do you think that the left-wing blog readers participate more? And here you define participation as voting, making donations, and trying to persuade other people to vote for a particular candidate, I think, right? So why are they more likely to participate than right-wing readers of right-wing blogs?
Well, this is something where we don't have very much direct evidence, and I think that there are two possible interpretations that you could bring to that data. One is that this is a somewhat depressing time, I think, for the right wing in many ways. There are many problems that I think many right wingers have with the people, with the presidency, with perhaps their political party. And so this may just be a reflection of a more general trend among right wingers that they tend to be somewhat more depressed than the general public are. But my interpretation is that that this may be true, but that there's something else going on. And what I think is going on is that the left wing of the blogosphere thinks of itself pretty clearly as being a social movement. It thinks of itself as being a movement which is out to change politics, which is out to change the Democratic Party. And if you read in particular the so-called Netroots blogs, blogs like Daily Kos or Atrios or other people like that, you see very frequently that they are appealing to you to support this or that candidate financially. And I suspect that these appeals are having a significant consequence in terms of creating this collective identity and creating a sense of solidarity, which makes it more likely that left of center blog readers are going to be participating actively in these three ways than right of center blog readers are.
But if the right wing people are so depressed about current president and the current state of the Republican Party in the United States, you'd think that they would be feeling more energetic and have a stronger motivation to try to organize than the left wingers, who seem to have everything going on their side.
Well, that I think is a pretty reasonable interpretation, because if you see where the Netroots crowd actually came from, I think that they came from not from success but from failure, or from the perceived failure of the Democratic Party to reflect their opinion, for example, on the Iraq War, to engage actively and vigorously in a back-to-back contest with the Republican Party. And so the Netroots, I think, basically began as a bunch of extremely pissed-off people who were angry at the failures of their party, so that if this was a simple reflection of depression in the state of your party, you might perhaps expect that Republicans, this would get Republicans more motivated to get involved in movement politics rather than less. Although I guess you could look at, for example, the Ron Paul phenomenon and the possibly if Bob Barr gets any support, you could look at these as being evidence that maybe Republicans who, in general rather than blog readers who are angry and annoyed and upset are looking for other options and looking to try and create a movement which is only somewhat semi-detached from the traditional means through which right-wingers have expressed their political opinions.
Okay, so everything might change in a few years if there's a Democratic president and conservatives are very unhappy with him, and maybe they would start mobilizing. And it doesn't seem to be the case that there's some particular appeal of the technology to the left as opposed to the right.
Well, there is, and this is something we find, that there is, in addition to these specific effects of mobilization, as it were, we find that there are a lot more left-wing blog readers out there in the population that we surveyed than right-wing blog readers. And so there may be this, there may also be some sorts of, lock-in effects which have begun to happen. And here you might think about, for example, talk radio, which was in many ways the blogosphere of the 1980s. And here we saw Republicans and right-wingers managing to establish a dominance in the media at a relatively early stage, which the left never really managed to catch up with, so that you saw various efforts such as Air America, none of which have been especially successful in trying to catch up with Rush Limbaugh and in trying to create this counter-mobilization in the talk radio sphere. So it may also be that there is an initial kind of lock-in, which is set in the internet. And certainly if you look at Republican strategists such as, for example, Patrick Ruffini, they're very, very worried at the ways in which the left of center seems to have established a comprehensive domination of the internet, and they want to try and change it.
So it may be that the internet appeals more to younger people, people who are more highly educated, and those would, I assume, be generally more liberal people.
Well, certainly at the moment, whatever opinion poll data we have suggests that there's a very, very strong generational shift which has happened, and I think this does spell trouble perhaps down the line for the Republican Party as people who are in their late teens, early 20s become more actively engaged in politics as people tend to do over the course of their life. If they have set their identities in stone, then this is something which is going to be somewhat problematic for the Republican Party because very clearly these people strongly favor Democratic candidates over Republican candidates.
So the invention of the internet that has maybe favored Democratic politics or people who are on the left.
Well, it has.
That is to say, you might start from the premise that any technological change, one might just say that the cost of communications have declined, wouldn't favor any particular ideological view. But in this particular case, it might just because just the nature of the technology appeals to people who have a certain ideological view. And so Al Gore, did a great job by inventing the internet because he advanced the interests of the Democratic Party as well as that of everybody in the world.
I guess that's so, but I don't think that there's anything necessarily inherent to the internet which makes it more attractive to left-wing people rather than right-wing people. I think that you've got to look at two different things here. One, the development of the technology, and the second is the social context in which the technology actually came to fruition. And if it's a social context in which is favorable in one way or another for the left, then you may see the left establish a kind of unstoppable advantage because it may well be that then, for example, Republican-minded people who look at the internet and look at internet participation are less inclined to get involved because they see this as a medium which is dominated by the right, or rather dominated by the left, and not very hospitable to the right, and they may create a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where each individual basically says, what's the point in doing this? And this helps to continue a left-wing dominance of a medium, which is not a natural thing, but just, I think, to some extent, an accident of history, of the particular president we had, of the particular state of the Democratic Party that we had, and of the particular people who went out there and decided to try and create and to forge their own identity.
I guess that's possible, but I think that couldn't be more than a short-term phenomenon. I mean, after all, even now it's easy enough for people who are on the right to find on the, as you say in your paper, to find on the internet all kinds of right-wing leaning blogs and other sources, and they do spend a lot of time there. So it may just be a matter of time before this advantage that's enjoyed by the left is lost.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is if you looked at the blogs, this is not a prediction that you would have made back in, say, for example, 2003, which is when I started to study this stuff seriously academically. The general perception then was that right-wing blogs were dominant in the blogosphere, and left-wing blogs had a lot of catching up to do.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something which really, I think, changed late 2003, early 2004. We really began to see, I think, the congealing of this group of left-wing bloggers around the Howard Dean campaign, which I think created the Netroots. I think we also saw, and this is something which gets less attention, we saw the creation of a bunch of bloggers who were really interested in policy, what I've sometimes called the wonkosphere, and these, I think, have had a pretty significant impact on policy discussions and policy debates here in DC. And again, the left managed to establish an advantage, which I think has managed to perpetuate itself over time.
Well, the question is always compared to what, and this is one of the reactions I had to your paper. I mean, one thing you could be interested in is, what's the effect of the invention of the blogosphere, the evolution of the blogosphere on politics? And so one has to ask this hypothetical, one has to look at the hypothetical world where the blogosphere was never invented. And it's not clear to me, I mean, I don't think you can really prove one thing or the other, but do you think that, well, it's very hard to ask this question, but do you think that politics and policy are different from what they would be if the blogosphere hadn't come into being? I mean, after all, you might just say that the blogging is a substitute for stuff that's been going on for hundreds of years, people meeting with each other, sending letters to each other, calling each other, organizing in various ways. It's probably made that a little bit easier because it's reduced the cost of doing that. It's done it for both sides of the political spectrum, although, as you point out, at least in the short term, it seems that the left has exploited this new technology more effectively than the right has. But otherwise, you know, things are probably not that different from the way they would be if blogging had never gotten started.
Well, I think there's some truth to that, but only some. And I think that the key that you point to here is where you say, okay, let's think about it this way. I think that you're right that in many ways the politics that we have, it's not something fundamentally new under the sun. It's something which is it's a new twist on old forms of organizing. And in many ways, if you look at these Netroots bloggers, the people who they most self-consciously identify themselves as emulating are right-wing movement activists back in the 1960s, back in the 1970s, the Barry Goldwater types who basically were disgusted with their party and decided to take it over. So in some ways, there are some real historical continuities and similarities. But the key here is, I think, the concept of transaction costs. And there's one thing that the internet has really done spectacularly, which is to dramatically lower the transaction costs of group formation. This is something that Clay Shirky spells out in his very interesting new book, Here Comes Everybody, that really the transaction costs of group formation have nosedived, and so perhaps we would have gotten some opposition emerging internally within the Democratic Party had it not been for the internet, and perhaps this would have vaguely resembled what we see today. Perhaps we would have seen some sort of a shift to the left. But I don't think we would have... My suspicion is that what we would have seen would have been much more muted and would have been organized by traditional political elites, perhaps some of the people such as Teddy Kennedy and others within the Senate who were never too particularly keen on the way that the party was going. And I think it would have had a quite different shape as a result. And so what I think the internet has done, it's given all of these people who have felt disconnected from politics an opportunity to organize and to mobilize on the web. And this is especially important for, say, people in places like Kansas or Texas or wherever, which may not have very strong democratic parties or very strong social contexts where these people could interact in and find others like them. And now they've got the internet and they can find others like them and they can organize that way.
And yet the Democratic Party seems as middle of the road as ever, doesn't it? It doesn't seem like these people are having that much effect in pulling it to the left. They might help the Democrats win the next presidential election and congressional elections and so forth. But it seems that, as we've seen in every presidential campaign, the candidates move to the center as soon as the primaries are over. And it seems like Obama, at least sometimes, maybe often, wants to argue that he's going to try to lead from the center rather than from the left.
Oh, well, that's a whole different set of issues, obviously. The extent to which Obama is genuinely centrist or genuinely liberal, and it's pretty hard for me, at least. You, I guess, have had him as a colleague in University of Chicago, so perhaps you've got a better take on this. It's very hard for me to evaluate, but I do think that there has been a significant and substantial shift to the left, especially on economic issues. If you see, for example, the ways in which people talk about globalization, the debate has changed here. The Democratic Leadership Council type traditional position on these issues has very much been eclipsed by a more vigorously left-wing position, more suspicious of globalization, certainly more suspicious of trade deals. Now, this may have a number of different causes. I think the net roots are only one among these causes, but I do think that they have had a significant impact in changing the debate.
Right. Well, you anticipated what I was going to say. I mean, you're talking over the last few years, and obviously, right, I mean, obviously a lot has been going on. The war in Iraq, which has been very polarizing, this economic downturn, the increasing inequality of wealth, all these things would independently polarize people and stimulate this type of grassroots or net roots or any type of roots movement on the left. So this is speculative to a certain extent. You know, you're also worried about polarization in your paper. I wanted to ask you about that. Do you think that when Gutenberg invented the printing press, people began to fret over the effect it would have on polarization? I mean, all technological change is going to affect people in some way, and yet your initial reaction might be it's going to polarize people. But why? I mean, why should we care about that in the first place? And second of all, you know, why would we think that a reduction in the cost of communication would polarize?
Well, I think here, okay. First of all, I guess I should clarify here. I'm actually not anywhere near as worried about polarization as some people. And this is really what the paper is. It's less about the worries of polarization in a certain sense and saying, if you're one of these people, and here another of your colleagues, Cass Sunstein, is the obvious example, who is worried about polarization and worried about its consequences for politics, then this is something which should worry you. If you're somebody who favors participation, who believes that increased participation is a good thing, then there are many aspects of this new technology that you're going to like. So I guess we're not so much coming down and saying we're worried about polarization and saying here are the theoretical debates, the debates that political philosophers and political theorists have about these issues. Here are what they think. Given these normative positions, if you have one normative position, this is evidence that should allow you to update your priors in one way. If you have another normative position. So I guess I'm not directly worried about polarization.
Okay, but fair enough. But let me just ask you as a matter of theory. So again, I would say if communication costs go down, that it's predictable. That is, one would assume, at least in a democratic society, that participation would increase, right? Because participation is costly. And you test that, and there's evidence of that, and which is interesting and good. On the polarization side, though, what should we think as a matter of theory? It's not clear to me that if communication costs go down, we should expect polarization to increase or decrease or stay the same. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, here is something we only touch upon a little bit in our paper, and you may be familiar with Cass's work on this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But let me approach it from a slightly different way, which is that there's a sociologists observe a pretty persistent pattern of human behavior, which is homophily. That is, that people like to try and associate with others who resemble them in many important respects, whether it be political opinion, whether it be class, whether it be race, whether it be whatever. The people tend to associate with other people who are like them. That they tend to prefer this, and when they can find these other people like them, they tend to get attached to them. Now, you can imagine that if this is true, that when you lower the cost of communication, you may make it easier for birds of a feather, in a certain sense, to flock together, for people who have the same opinion to come together and to find others like them and to generate these sort of little networks of people who are like them and to be less likely to find other people who are unlike them. And from the perspective of somebody like Cass Sunstein, Cass would argue that this is something which is dangerous in two ways. First of all, it means that that when you get people who are together, who have the same opinion, they tend to reinforce each other's point of view. They tend to drive each other sort of further and further into what Cass perceives, and I don't share this perception, into what may potentially be some quite extreme positions. And secondly, you don't have the kind of deliberative debate between people of different political positions, which might allow you to revise your own opinions and to realize that maybe some things that you took for granted actually were not things that you should take for granted, and that you may be quite wrong. So I think that would be the Sunstein argument about, you know, this would be the argument, and I think the empirical argument is that homophily, I think, is definitely happening. The theoretical argument is this something we should be worried about? Is this something we should not be worried about? And while I think there are some causes for concern, I'm not anywhere near as pessimistic as Cass is. And I think that in some ways you can have increased possibilities for political effectiveness precisely when you're able to identify other people who are like you. And this is the basis, for example, of political parties. They're means that allow individuals who share basic perceptions of politics to aggregate together and to serve as a kind of force multiplier.
Yeah, well, I think we agree. Let me just add that, I mean, the problem with the view that you described, though did not endorse, is that once you've spent some time with your group, you know, having fun and talking to each other and agreeing with each other about all kinds of great stuff, you still have to if you want to change things, you still have to go to the political process and get your votes, and usually that means creating compromising with people in the other group, or usually trying to break off a subgroup from that opposite group, and that means communicating with them, and that means persuading them that they should agree with you rather than the other guys. And if communication costs are lower because of blogging and the internet, that might be easier rather than harder. So it strikes me that theoretically this is quite ambiguous. But I think we just agree on this. So
I think really what it comes down to is there are two kinds of implicit positions in these debates. One, which is a position that really we want to have some sort of moderation. We want to have forces which pull us to the, which pull positions to the center, which, sort of identify meaningful forms of agreement that are, sort of a moderate left or moderate right or whatever. The other is to say that it may be better and it may present clearer and realer choices if you have sharply defined, distinct political positions, which then are forced to come together in a process that's partly going to be competitive, partly going to be about trying to reach accommodation where accommodation is necessary. And I'm certainly somebody who inclines to the latter point of view, whereas I suspect Cass is somebody who's more inclined towards the former.
Well, everything depends on whether the center is right or not. Sometimes
exactly.
The center is right, sometimes it's wrong. And sometimes the people on the extreme turn out to be right. So it's very hard to say in the abstract. But this, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and the center, of course, shifts. And basically, as you say, we've no idea if there's some underlying truth function out there or whatever. We've no idea what that function looks like, and we've no necessary reason to believe that the correct positions are going to be clumped closer to the center than they are to the extremes.
Aside from maximizing a social welfare function, anyway,
well,
that before you can respond to that, that leads to the second topic, which is basically the same topic. You wanted to talk a bit about this Brooks column, maybe you could say a bit why and what you thought about it.
Well, I think that Brooks is It's been interesting for me to follow Brooks over the last number of months, because he's clearly somebody, he was hired by the New York Times as being a kind of a definite conservative, but shall we say, I think some, you know, a conservative who is going to be, who is going to appear to be polite and thoughtful and moderate and all of these things. And clearly he's been, my impression is that he's been struggling in different ways. I think there was an interview, was it with George Packer, where he basically talked about how he thought that the Republican movement, I believe, you know, he used frank Anglo-Saxon language. I'm not sure how much we're supposed to do on this on Blogging Heads. We're not subject to FCC rules on this, but anyway, he was pretty blunt in how he described the current intellectual state, as he saw it, of the conservative and Republican movement. And here I think he wrote this interesting piece, which is basically arguing that if we need to, if we want to make any progress, and the we here being the being conservatives and the right, we need to look to a bunch of younger intellectuals, several of whom are bloggers, a couple of whom are more associated with particular, you know, with the National Review or other publications, and that these people are basically trying to break the mold of conservative thinking on these issues, and that we really need to go with them rather than to follow on the tired old tropes of the conservative movement as it is at the moment. And so I thought that was something which is a kind of interesting statement from somebody who used to be pretty well, I think, pretty clearly and pretty correctly perceived as being part of the movement, albeit one of the more, quote, thoughtful, unquote, members. But here's somebody who's saying we need to basically start anew, look to these new ideas, and abandon a lot of what we've had in the past. And so I thought that was an interesting challenge to the right.
Yeah, no. See, I have to admit, I find everything confusing about this column and what you say about it. Is he criticizing the Republican Party or conservatives or people with conservative instincts or some kind of conservative intellectual movement like the neoconservatives or I mean, what exactly is the target here? I can see the Republican Party is obviously in disarray and doing badly for lots of obvious reasons. But that's not much of a target. I mean, it may just be poorly organized and poorly led right now, as the Democratic Party has in the recent past, and it'll recover and set and position itself to the right of wherever the center of American politics turn out to be. So okay, so much for the Republican Party. But he seems to have a different concern from that, do you think? Or is it just about the Republican Party?
No, I think it's more, well, it's partly about the Republican Party, but I think it's more to do with the, with, as you say, the underlying intellectual issues.
And
yeah. Here, if I, so here, if I could diagnose this, I think Brooks' argument would be probably some, and here, you know, so I'm guessing and speculating to some extent, but I think that his grievances with the current state of affairs would be twofold. First of all, that this kind of radical element in republicanism, this idea, or in conservatism, this idea, for example, that you can go into a country like Iraq and turn it upside down and completely remake it into a new democratic society. And this also has its domestic elements with some of the more extreme advocates, for example, of starve the beast, tax cutting and whatever, that this more radical element has run its course. And this is something which Brooks, he used to be, for example, quite keen on many of the people who were basically proposing to change the world, this so-called national greatness conservatism, which he was an advocate of a few years ago, and he very definitely seems to have changed his tune on that. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that I think he's arguing here implicitly, and this is with reference to the Dawood and Salam book that he's talking about. I haven't read the book, but I read the article that gave rise to the book, is that the Republicans need to figure out a way to connect with people who aren't rich. That right. This is that one of their major problems is that they become more and more beholden to a relatively narrow set of interests, that they need to figure out how to connect with what these two authors refer to as Sam's Club Republicans, and they need to figure out ways better to reflect these people's interests, or else they're going to lose whatever working class, lower middle class base they have. And then the Republican Party is really going to be screwed for a long, long period of time.
So the solution to the problems of conservatism is to become liberal?
I think I'm sort of liberal-light as the... and, you know, sort of the this raises some interesting questions. You know, sort of how far can the conservatives go in this direction mm-hmm. without losing what it is that makes them conservative? And here I think that I guess that really what Brooks and what these people are pointing to is something which is more like a European Christian democratic form of conservatism, something right. like the CDU in Germany, you know, sort of which is, or maybe even the CSU, which is the Bavarian equivalent, which on the one hand is a sort of pretty strong on a sort of, quote, morality, unquote, issues, is big on having crucifixes in classrooms and things like that, right. but on the other hand is also believes in the social market economy, that economics should not be allowed to disrupt communities, that there should be help for these things and whatever. So they
just seem to think that the American public is moving to the left and the Republican Party is going to have to move a bit to the left or else it will never have political power again. Is it any more than that? I should say also, with respect to the first point, mm-hmm. there are people on the left and the right who, there have always been people on the left and increasingly, or in recent years on the right, who've been in favor of, you know, going into foreign countries and converting them into democracies. So that doesn't strike me as conservative so much as just a big blunder of the Republican Party mm-hmm. under Bush's leadership, the Iraq invasion. Maybe they're mixing up, and this gets back to what I was saying earlier, maybe they're just yeah. mixing up the party problem and the question of conservatism. So over the last few years, the Republican Party has made a number of mistakes. And in addition, in the recent past, the economy has done badly, and there have been all kinds of sort of probably temporary phenomena that have concerned people, but those will pass. And the Republican Party may have to adopt new policies in some respect, but I don't see that as a critique of conservatism in general so much as how the party positions itself in order to ensure that it maintains power and is not too distant from whatever the center of the American public is.
Well, there's certainly some of that there, and one of the criticisms that this book that Brooks talks about has gotten from people like Matt Iglesias and other sort of blogger, young intellectual types, is that it really is basically a patina of we really care about these issues smeared upon there isn't really all that much more in there than electoral posturing, mm-hmm. and that the chances of the Republican Party taking up whatever there is that is more than that in there in the next number of years, given its internal constellations, are next to zero. But as a query, I mean, do you personally consider yourself to be a conservative, a libertarian? Do you have any specific labels that you attach to yourself, or are you
unlabeled, labeled?
Unlabeled.
Just perfectly unique in my views and therefore defy all types of political labeling. I'm conservative about some things and liberal about other things. So in some respects, I suppose I'm worried. Our viewers are falling asleep. But so I tend to be like a lot of conservative academics, quite liberal about social issues. I'm much more probably optimistic about the market economy than most academics are. I don't know whether that makes me to the right or how far on the right in the sort of regular political spectrum. And then my recent writing has been I think generally considered conservative because it supports the aggressive measures that the Bush administration has taken against terrorist extremism. So, I mean, I guess I have to admit I don't really care much about the Republican Party. I mean, I guess I just don't really care much about whether it does well or poorly. I think, like the Democratic Party, people who belong to that party will be pragmatic and they'll realize that if they stick with positions that were popular 10 years ago and are not popular today, they're not going to have any power. So they'll adjust. And in a few years, maybe 4 years, maybe they'll just take one term of a Democratic president, which people will get upset with, you know, basically, because there's so many serious problems that are very, very challenging for whoever happens to be president, that the Republican Party will resurrect itself. So I think these people, they're looking at little short-term bumps and trying to extrapolate, and that's probably impossible to do. I think there's a more interesting question about conservatism in general, but I guess, you know, I'm not a political theorist, and I do think that in the past, maybe in the 1980s, conservatism, there was some kind of conservative intellectual movement that was more appealing than whatever there is today, partly because it won on some issues, at least temporarily. It won on the Cold War issues. It won on, at least for the short term, or to some extent, on economic issues. And it lost on cultural issues, but I think that's fine. I mean, or the social issues, from my perspective. And whatever is conservatism today, it may be a little less coherent, although I guess I'm not sure whether that really matters, one way or the other.
Okay, well, it sounds like that's a good segue into our next topic, which is to start talking about some of the stuff that we probably actually disagree vigorously on, which is the issues about the war on terror, the issues about international law, and whether or not, for example, the if I'm pronouncing it right, the Boumediene decision and all of these other, the recent pattern of jurisprudence. I saw that there was a new case in the D.C. District Court yesterday night as well. The ways in which these have changed the ways in which the U.S. state can or cannot behave with regard to things like Guantanamo, and whether or not it's a good or bad thing that the U.S. is being restricted from doing some of the things that, for example, it was able to do with regard to not providing habeas to prisoners in Guantanamo or whatever.
Okay, well, why don't we start with Boumediene, and I think one of the major effects of that decision will be to make Guantanamo Bay a less appealing, the internment of people in Guantanamo Bay a less appealing policy for the U.S. government. I mean, one of the reasons why they set that up in the first place is that they thought that habeas would not extend to Guantanamo Bay. And they believed that because they relied on earlier Supreme Court precedents, which strongly suggested that. In this respect, the Bush administration's legal position was not particularly, it was a perfectly reasonable view from a legal perspective. So that's changed. And I believe that both candidates want to shut down Guantanamo Bay. Because whatever the legal issues that are involved, it's become a political liability. But the problem remains, which is, what do you do with the people who are there? Or what do you do with new people who are picked up, either on the battlefield or not on the battlefield, but who pose a significant terrorist threat? And I assume that what's going to happen, whether Obama or McCain becomes president, is that they'll just have, Guantanamo Bay-style internment camps in other countries. That'll be the main effect of the Supreme Court ruling. And as we already know, these camps in other countries, they already exist, but they're a lot less visible. And it'll be more difficult for the judiciary to try to extend control over them, whether that might happen. So in terms of substance, I doubt much will change. That is, the things that the critics of the Bush administration are concerned about. And I think that that's just a big problem about what to do with the people who are picked up. What do you think?
On the Guantanamo issue, this is something that Marty Lederman, who's been one of the most vigorous critics of the Bush administration, I believe, said a couple of years ago that he thought that it was a bad idea to close Guantanamo down precisely for some of these reasons, that he thought that the real abuses were having in the black sites, which we didn't have very much at all in the way of publicity or control over. But more generally, I think that the fundamental issue here, I think there's some fundamental moral and ethical issues here, mm-hmm. which is, do we really want to have black holes where the law cannot reach? And I think this was part of the logic of the Guantanamo thing, that, as you say, this was a zone which had an ambiguous status in terms of how, not having a legal system, it appeared that could necessarily reach in there. I think that's something which is problematic. And I also think that it's a really bad idea and has been demonstrably a really bad idea for the U.S. in terms of the international publicity that it has gotten as a result not only of Guantanamo, but extraordinary renditions, all of these other things, where the Bush administration seems, as your former co-author, Jack Goldsmith, who certainly doesn't seem to me to be a wilting liberal pansy on this, when I say pansy, I mean in the sense of a flower rather than in any homophobic way, a wilting. He doesn't seem to be a wilting violet on this or on any of the other on any of the other issues which have come up. But nonetheless, one gets the sense that he felt that the Bush administration was going way, way, way too far on many of these things.
But he made it. His criticism is narrower, and I don't think really would address your concerns. His criticism was that the Bush administration should have obtained more explicit authorization from Congress before taking the various controversial actions that it did. He also thought that Congress would have given him the authorization that he sought. In fact, Congress has in the Detainee Treatment Act and the Military Commissions Act. The problem with that view now is that at least after Boumediene
has basically said that even if the Congress does this with the administration, that it still violates constitutional rights.
Pardon me?
My understanding of the Boumediene case is that
right.
It is that, yeah.
Yeah, so the Boumediene case, actually rejects Jack's view. But I putting aside Jack, but Henry, let me just ask you, and we can mm-hmm. we can address the legal issues in a moment. What do you think is the appropriate thing for the U.S. government and other governments to do with respect to this group of people? And you can define it in various ways, but people who are picked up on the battlefield, people who for whom there's good classified intelligence that they're involved in some way with Al Qaeda. Do you think? I mean, what would be the ethically appropriate way for governments to deal with these people?
Well, I'll grant you that it's a tough and it's a difficult problem, given that many of these people are going to go out and, if they're let free, and presumably seek to kill again. But I also I guess my take on this is I would prefer to have seen a restricted court system which was more clearly within the sort of conventional U.S. Sort of legal system, with clearer rights of appeal to the perhaps something like the FISA court, that is a specialized court system which wasn't directly part of the military court system. Because one of the other things that I think we've seen very clearly emerging from the last several months, and from some of the revelations this former prosecutor has made and others, is that the system became extremely politicized, and I think it's very hard, and sort of given the way that the military works, for it not to become politicized.
The military system. Status Review Tribunal of the military.
Exactly. And so I do think that there is a case to be made there for a restricted court system where I do think that there is a case to be made for example, the defense not having access to all of the information which is available to the judges, in making the final determinations. Because if there is real intelligence here, then there is real intelligence. But I also think that the current system, as it exists, not only is wide open to abuses, but has been demonstrably abused. And here, when you see something like David Semtel, of all people, basically concurring an opinion saying that the logic that the state has advanced in declaring somebody to be an enemy combatant is an Alice in Wonderland logic. So when you see people like Semtel saying this, there's something deeply, fundamentally, irremediably wrong in the system as it exists.
Let's see. So you said a lot of things there, many of which I agree with. Some small points, first of all. Mm-hmm. The big problem is the secrecy problem. That is, it's extremely difficult to evaluate what's going on since we don't have access to intelligence. Now that's something that one has to address. And unfortunately, the problem here is that since the Bush administration has lost a lot of its credibility, maybe for many people all of its credibility, people are less willing to simply trust the administration when it makes assertions about people. Unfortunately, if you take that logic to the extreme, it just makes everything impossible. Because of course, in intelligence and in lots of areas of life, the executive branch has to act on secret information. I mean, it's just when it processes tax returns, there's secret information. We don't want to make it too easy for people to have access to that information, which makes it very hard for people in the public and the media to evaluate what it does. Now you say. You'll appreciate that, and you say that you would be willing to consider a type of hybrid court or new type of court where, for example, the government would not have to share information with the defendant, although would have to share classified information with the lawyer. Well, that might be, the optimal system, but it's just a dart thrown along the spectrum here between security on one side and liberty on the other side. What civil libertarians will say to that is, look, the lawyer is not going to be able to mount an adequate defense unless you can ask his client whether this particular information that the government has revealed about you could be true. Suppose the classified cable refers to the defendant by name doing all these horrible things, and it turns out that the defendant could easily tell his lawyer, well, that wasn't me. They've mixed up my name with someone else, which apparently has actually happened. So, and then on the other side, what the government will say is, well, when you start giving information to lawyers, it gets leaked out, and there's evidence of that as well. Lawyers, in one case, a lawyer deliberately has released classified information. But I think that the bigger problem is just that the more people who have access to information, the more likely that this information will get out. So anyway, so this is why it's a difficult problem, as we agree. There are two issues. One is, well, just how should we pick, what spot should we pick along the spectrum on one extreme, traditional law enforcement protections, where classified information would not be allowed or would only be allowed under, really narrow circumstances. And to the other extreme, this kind of military commission where the military can pretty much do what it wants. Nobody really knows, and I think this is part of the problem. The military experimented. It made a lot of bad mistakes. Whether they were bad mistakes at the time or with the benefit of hindsight is a more complicated question. A lot of what it did involved depending on what it had done in the past, which is usually a reasonable way to start. So traditionally people who are picked up in wars don't get much process, at least for the detention issue. And of course, everybody's responded by saying, well, this is not a traditional war. True. So this is a difficult problem.
Well, I guess, so first of all, I do think that there should be some right of judicial, and this is where I do agree with the Boumediene case. I do think there should be some right of judicial review, a proper right of judicial review for the initial declaration of enemy combatant status. And I think this is something which, with some restrictions on information, is probably not going to generate all that much in the way of serious problems for the system. If we pick up Osama bin Laden, there's not much doubt about whether or not he's an enemy combatant. He can appeal, but his appeal is pretty clearly going to be rejected.
That's the easiest case, though. I mean, the problem is that in order to pick up Osama bin Laden, first you have to pick up lots of other people. As the person you mentioned, Marty Letterman, has pointed out, a lot of what they're doing is they're looking for needles in haystacks. So they're picking up lots of people, hoping that they'll have a bit of information. Usually releasing them when it turns out that they don't, but not always, because they're not so sure, because maybe there's some hole in the person's story that they want to check out, and that takes some time. And then that's the difficult case, because, so traditionally, historically, federal courts have never been involved in the decision whether to detain somebody picked up on a battlefield, or, people picked up, again, the battlefield, even in regular wars, is often ambiguous. It's not just where people are firing at each other. It could be where spies are, propagandists or whatever. People in third-party countries, for example, in Switzerland or whatever. People are picked up, kidnapped, what have you. And the question is whether the federal judge should be involved. Now, one interpretation of this circuit court case that you mentioned, even if Sentel is very right-wing and so forth, is that these guys are judges. They don't know anything about the military or what the military is trying to accomplish. They don't have the expertise. that is needed in order to evaluate the military's decision whether to pick them up. Now, true, on the other side, and this is what you're emphasizing, they're going to correct at least some errors, and the whole system will look fairer as a result, but they're inevitably going to make errors as well. And we actually don't know, in this case, whether the court is making an error or the military is making
an
error.
Yeah, of course we don't. And there is no way under any legal system to automatically correct all errors. But I think the point is here that under the current system as it exists, there have been very, very strong reasons to make sure that certain errors, perhaps systematically, continue to go uncorrected. And here, for example, I think it really leaves a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths when a senior military lawyer basically testifies before Congress and says that his boss made it clear that under no circumstances could certain people who are under accusation basically win a trial. Even if these people look on the surface to be guilty of sin, that suggests a system of decision making and determination of people's fates, which is fundamentally unfair, which is basically give them a fair trial and hang them kind of approach. Right. Not only does this seem to me to be procedurally deeply, deeply problematic, but from the point of view of international relations, this is a lousy, lousy way to go. There's no doubt that there's been enormous damage done to the U.S. by internationally, especially in the Arab world, by many of the ways in which it's handled these issues.
I'd like to talk about that issue, but one last point. There's a difference from looking at what the Bush administration did and criticizing it, and the general design issue, which is looking forward, how should we design this system? And you're quite right that one of the factors that will go into the design of the system is what is the discretion it gives the executive branch. So if you give the executive branch discretion, it will abuse it sometimes, and other times it will exploit it in ways that are advantageous relative to what you'd have in the traditional law enforcement system. The entire military justice system is within the executive branch, and the traditional detention decision was traditionally in the executive branch. This has served, this country and all other countries well, I suppose. It's been what people have done for decades. And it seems to me, you could go back and look at World War II and all these other wars and look at, they pick up enemy soldiers. I'm sure all kinds of abuses took place. And the question is whether some kind of judicial oversight for the purpose of correcting those abuses would have actually made the overall system work better or not. It's very hard to say. I think the presumption has to be that it would not have worked better in the past, and then the argument has to be, well, there's something different about the current conflict which would justify greater judicial oversight than has occurred in the past, or something different in national and international norms and the sense of what's appropriate. And this actually leads to the last point you made. But tell me, what exactly is the damage that's been done to the United States? What concretely can you point to that we should be concerned about?
Well, here I think that there are a couple of two basic forms of damage. One is set out in this new article by Antonia Chase, who I take it is a member of this family of international legal scholars and political international relations people, which I sent you yesterday, which just appeared in International Security, which basically suggests that to the extent that the U.S. is not perceived as being law-abiding, it hurts its relationships with other allies.
Right.
The second, I think, is sort of more visceral and more direct, and also touches on issues that we haven't talked about, such as the extraordinary rendition of people to countries where, bluntly, the clear intention is that these people are going to be interrogated brutally and tortured in ways which would be difficult for the U.S. to get away with on its own, so they're sent off to or that country, Uzbekistan or wherever. These sort of generate the impression of the United States as bluntly being a tyrant, an oppressor, you know, sort of a sort of country which comes in, which takes people without any due process, and basically subjects them to all sorts of deeply unpleasant things. Now, perhaps, you know, undoubtedly, many Arab regimes do the same and worse to their own citizens, but it also is, I think, more difficult for somebody to come in as an outside power and to do that without a sort of very, very substantial repercussions in terms of the that actor's reputation. And certainly, if you look at the reputation of the U.S. over the last number of years in various opinion polls that Pew and other people have taken internationally, you see that the U.S. International reputation is in the doghouse, and that clearly carries a lot of costs and consequences for the U.S. and for U.S. citizens.
Well, that's why I asked for the concrete examples. I mean, the Chase paper makes a number of assertions about how the reputation of the United States has been injured. And I agree, it has been. But the question is what the costs are and how to measure those costs against the benefits, if there are any, from engaging in these practices, which I should say have, you know, often been with the cooperation of European governments. So the European governments appear also to agree with the U.S. government that they're willing to take the risk of the reputational hit in order to obtain whatever benefits they get from
Let me just specify elements within these European governments. It hasn't been clear at all stages. For example, in the Italian case, which I think is the one that has received most attention, it's still not clear who in the Italian government, as opposed to Niccolo Pallari and others in the Italian intelligence services, actually knew about the decisions that had or had not been taken.
But the rendition practice goes back to the Clinton administration in the 90s, and I thought, I may be wrong about this, I thought that there was a great deal of international cooperation in these renditions. Perhaps I'm wrong about that. Certainly there was much less, there was criticism of them among human rights groups, but not the type of criticism that we have now. And the reason, of course, is that the Bush administration has engaged in this practice more aggressively than in the past. But if you ask the Bush administration, why are you doing this, they'll say, well, the stakes are higher now than they were in the past. And so the costs in terms of international reputation are less than the benefits that we've obtained in the form of enhanced security.
Well, let me just ask you a pretty blunt question. Do you think that it's moral and ethical, whether for the Bush administration or for other European countries which have been cooperating, to effectively outsource torture to other regimes?
Well, I think that in extreme cases, it depends a lot on exactly what happens. But I think, you know, in the abstract, in the extreme cases, taking using harsh interrogation practices or threatening people in order to prevent an attack of some sort is justified. I also think that this is actually the mainstream view. Certainly I think it's the mainstream view among governments. I don't think it's much more difficult than the view whether, for example, intervening in Kosovo, which will predictably involve killing lots of civilians, is justified for the sake of the benefits, which is to prevent a much worse outcome, which is a genocide. So this is these decisions that these governments have to make every day. They can certainly be made incorrectly. It may be the case that every single rendition decision that the Clinton administration and the Bush administration have made have been wrong. You know, I don't know enough about them to be able to evaluate them. But I don't think governments could operate if they took the view that they can never engage in harsh practices for the sake of security.
Well, let me just pull you up on what you said, because I don't think that those two cases are really analogous at all, the case of going in Kosovo and the case of deliberately deciding to torture somebody. And this is something that, for example, you know, so I believe the Israeli government has made that argument that when, you know, so people get killed, when Ejan seeks to launch a rocket attack, for example, in order to take out some Hamas leader, that this is fundamentally morally different from an attack which is deliberately aimed at civilians. And I think there's a clear question of intentionality involved here. So if you are deliberately and specifically seeking to torture somebody, in order to get information from them. I think that that is sort of on a very different moral and ethical level, and I think that this goes back for several centuries of common law jurisprudence, and I think with very good reason. People remember quite well what happened in 16th and 17th century England, and I think there is a fundamental abhorrence there, which personally I think is a justified abhorrence.
Yeah, so you're making a distinction between... I'm not sure I understand. You're making
a distinction...
Let's take killing, because that's a little clearer. So we're at war with somebody, and we know that if we drop bombs in that country, we're going to kill lots of people, including lots of civilians. So, of course, we're not deliberately targeting a particular individual civilian in order to enhance our security, that is, to protect ourselves from this other country. But that's clearly what's going to happen. And that trade-off seems justified to governments in a range of cases. So do you disagree with that?
Well, what I'm saying is that there's a difference between, on the one hand, for example, conducting a bombing campaign, launching a rocket, for example, where you know that there is a substantial chance that civilians will be killed, as well as, say, the Hamas leader who you're seeking to take out, and on the other hand, seeking to deliberately target civilians as a means, for example, of spreading terror among the population. Now, that is not to say that I, by all means, at all necessarily endorse the first. I think that that's very problematic in its own right. But I do think that there is a real case to be made, that there's a very significant difference between, on the one hand, accepting that there's a real risk that people are going to be killed as an indirect consequence of your actions, and on the other hand, deliberately and specifically setting out to kill somebody.
Well, I guess I don't know whether we're going to be able to resolve this. The distinction seems artificial to me. In terms of historical practice, I mean, if you take, for example, World War II, and I realize, just for the reasons that you give, a lot of people think that, let's say, area bombing German cities by the British, and I believe the U.S. eventually as well, was just a war crime, because it was intended to create terror, or as they would say, to demoralize the public in order to hasten an end to World War II. Now, you could say, what a lot of people say is that it was totally unnecessary. Well, if it was totally unnecessary, then I agree. They should not have done that. But let's suppose that it was a reasonable thing to do. And the effect of that was to cause World War II to end a couple years earlier than it would have otherwise, save a few extra, a few more million civilians, and including the people in the concentration camps and so forth. I think that's a decision that a government has to make and will often be justified, although, of course, it's quite a horrible decision and not one that I would want to have to be in the position of making. What do you think about that? Do you think
Back, because you're basically arguing on more or less utilitarian lines.
That's what I am, so.
I'm
going to resolve that old debate.
Yeah, no, we're not going to resolve that old debate. But let me push back with you, I'm often extremely critical of Israel and some of the ways in which it has behaved towards the Palestinian population. But I remember a case from a number of years ago. This was one of the guys who I believe the Palestinian Authority or Hamas wanted to get released in one of these prisoner exchanges. Somebody who'd been guilty of creeping into a settlement and basically, killing a mother, killing a 3-year-old, basically going in there deliberately in order to kill a family, including small children who clearly were not directly involved in any, cannot be treated as being independent moral agents who had chosen to be in that settlement or whatever. Is that murder equivalent to, Israel seeking to get some guy from Hamas and accidentally killing a 3-year-old or two 3-year-olds as an indirect result of trying to get the guy from Hamas? Because it seems to me that's where your argument is leading, and I guess all arguments lead you to bite bullets in a certain sense, but that seems to me to be where your argument is going.
What, that they're equivalents?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I agree. I think government should, they should look at things in a utilitarian fashion, taking into account the well-being of their own citizens, and in an ideal world, the citizens of other countries as well. And I think that the personal morality that we comply with in our everyday life has got to be different from what governments has got to be different from what governments do, because the governments are responsible for protecting people in their country and ensuring their well-being, and that's often not going to be consistent with the type of morality that we're accustomed to guide our own individual actions. But we drifted a little bit from what I was hoping to get you to talk about, mm-hmm. which was the concrete reputational cost to the United States. In other words, we might say, look, the ethics here are ambiguous. We don't really know what is ethically proper for the U.S. government. Or you may know, and I may think I know, but we disagree. But where we can agree, or you know, where people might be willing to agree anyway, certainly I would agree, is that if the U.S. government does something that violates, you know, your sense of ethics, and that makes it much more difficult for the United States as a result to protect Americans and help other people in the world, then it shouldn't do that. But here I'm skeptical. In other words, I've seen these opinion polls also. We know there's a long history of ambivalence or even hatred of the United States, and particularly when it does highly aggressive things. The Vietnam War was another example of that. But it's never really clear to me how one cashes this out. That is to say, other countries continue to cooperate with the United States along a range of issues because, of course, they have an interest in doing so. And how do we tell at what point the U.S. has crossed the line, and as a result of its actions, in the aggregate, it's actually injuring itself rather than promoting its interests. I find it very hard to get a handle on this question.
Well, to some extent, it's obviously got to be a judgment call. But here, I think, for example, the work of experts on what actually the debates are within Arab societies is extremely helpful. And here, in particular, I'm thinking of a work of somebody who's just joined me as a colleague here, Mark Lynch, who's done some very interesting work on public debates in Arab society. Mm-hmm. And basically, his argument is that you've got a sort of an ideological battle going on within Arab society, which is basically between, on the one hand, the extreme Bin Laden type jihadist Muslims, and on the other hand, the sort of a more moderate Muslim center or center of opinion, which is certainly not by any means friendly to the United States, but is not sort of devoted to all-out war with the U.S. and probably would be content to be hostile in a passive rather than an active manner. And so, if this is true, well, you can very clearly see how actions such as revelations of torture, revelations of the large number of people who've died in U.S. custody, sometimes as a result of beatings and whatever, how these revelations are very clearly going to help push people away from this sort of more passive form of hostility to the U.S. to active aggression against the U.S.
But that's not what's happened, though. That is to say, the moderates are on the ascendancy. And if this theory were true that moderate Arabs are getting angry at the United States because of its aggressive actions, you'd think that the more radical people would be doing better. But these opinion polls show that Muslims in the Middle East are supporting the radicals less. Let me just finish this point, and then please, I'd like to hear what you say. But maybe this is just, of course, a conjecture and probably a crazy conjecture. Mm-hmm. But maybe the reason why the moderates are doing better is that the radicals have failed. The radicals were crushed in Afghanistan. They don't seem to be doing well anywhere in Iraq, and maybe that's because the United States and other countries have acted so aggressively. And so with this sort of extremist approach, which may have seemed appealing 10 years ago or 8 years ago, with this extremist approach failing, maybe the moderates, although of course unhappy with lots of what the United States has been doing, have nonetheless attracted new adherents that they might not otherwise have gotten.
Well, here again, I'm basically borrowing from the work of Lynch. I think the probable mistake with this is that it sees this debate as being entirely a debate about the role of the U.S., whereas it's also a debate about the radicals themselves. And here, Lynch, I think, makes a very useful distinction between two specific strands within within jihadi and sort of terrorism. One is the strand associated with bin Laden, which has effectively sought to create, move the moderates and sort of aggressively in its direction, and has sought to try and create new caliphate, which clearly requires it building up some mass support. And so its main appeal has, according to Lynch's analysis of the ways in which these appeals have been conducted, its main appeal has been precisely to try and move the moderates in its direction. On the other hand, you get people like the late unlamented Zarqawi, who were uninterested in trying to establish a broader political base, and basically were seeking to appeal to those who are already extremely disaffected through beheading videos and whatever. So I think the more plausible account of what's happening is not so much that the U.S. has basically beaten the radicals into submission, as that some of the more extreme radicals have behaved in ways which were deeply unappealing to the Muslim moderates.
Okay, and it still leaves the question open about whether the... I mean, this is a complicated sort of causal story, or we'd have to think that there are fewer moderates, even though there are fewer moderates as a result of the mistakes made by the extremists, there are more than there would have been if the U.S. had taken a less aggressive approach.
We're a little bit over time, the time mm-hmm. that these things usually run. So let me just close with one question to you. Do you think or do you not think that sort of going into Iraq and invading Iraq two separate questions. Do you think that going to Iraq was a good or a bad thing in terms of sort of winning this set of battles? And secondly, do you think that aggressive methodologies such as torture, such as whatever, do you think that they similarly are a good or bad thing in fighting this particular war?
Well, I think the Iraq decision was clearly wrong. It was clearly wrong with the benefit of hindsight. I think it was probably wrong at the time as well, It was a big mistake. It was a big mistake, we know, in general, but it had a lot of motivations, not just, this kind of, I think, crazy idea that invading Iraq might help in subduing al-Qaeda. But that, of course, has nothing to do with what I'm interested in, which is the role of the judiciary. The judiciary would never have said, and I don't think we would want the judiciary to say, you can't go to war because it violates the Constitution or some such thing. On the second question, I just don't know the answer. I wish I did. I think probably, with the benefit of hindsight, the Bush administration probably was too aggressive. And it may be because al-Qaeda turns out not to have been as big a threat as people understandably thought after 9/11. So, partly for the reasons that you gave, that maybe, and here I really don't know much about this, but maybe it's just not that viable an ideology, that it's just not one that is appealing enough so that it could sustain itself. And so, in the end, a lot of these aggressive measures may have been unnecessary and self-destructive. On torture, as I said, as a utilitarian, I think there are you can think of good hypothetical cases where it would be justified. It may well turn out to be, and maybe this is actually the case, that it's just a mistake as a matter of international relations. That is, the U.S. just shouldn't have done it. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. That New York Times article that came out quite recently about torture, it seemed to me pretty clear that it did lead to information being revealed. But as you point out, it makes one morally queasy, and it may have serious side effects that just make it a stupid thing to do in general. I guess that's increasingly my view as time passes, that it probably was a mistake. But on the much more mainstream types of stuff, detentions, military commissions, or basically, and here you seem to agree with me, trials of suspected terrorists that do not have all the procedural protections that ordinary law enforcement trials have. And going back to detentions, again, detentions, I think you agree with me, that they can be justified, even though, this is not permitted in traditional law enforcement, except in narrow circumstances. Those sorts of things, I think, have got to be part of the toolkit And I think they're justified. And yes, there are complicated questions about the right level of procedural protections and which branch of government in the United States should have the should be making the decisions or should have the you know the most authority or how this authority should be divided. And it's very hard to say with any confidence what the right answer is because, as I mentioned before, we just don't have very much information about what's happened and whether the current approach has been effective. Although we know many of the costs of it. So I'm sorry to give a kind of such a mushy and mealy-mouthed response to your very straightforward question, but those are my views at any rate.
Okay, well, I guess we probably should leave it there because we're now, I think, an hour and 15 minutes, which is 15 minutes longer than I think we're supposed to be.
Okay.
So we will leave it to the masters of blogging heads to decide whether any of this ends up on the cutting floor.
Okay.
Okay, thanks for talking to me, Eric.
Okay, thanks, Henry. That was fun.
Okay, bye.
Bye.